On this edition for Sunday, November 22nd, another setback for the Trump administration as more states move to certify the election results. COVID cases surge ahead of the Thanksgiving holiday. And reckoning with history, a Maryland college unveils a memorial to enslaved peoples. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Klorfein Foundation, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular has been offering no-contract wireless plans designed to help people do more of what they like. Our U.S.-based customer service team can help find a plan that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. The president lost the popular vote and continues to lose in court challenges to the election in multiple states. Yet he insists on disputing the certification of ballots showing Joe Biden is the president-elect. Yesterday, a federal judge dismissed Mr. Trump's case, asking that nearly 7 million Pennsylvania ballots be thrown out. Judge Matthew Brand wrote that the Trump lawyers presented a case with, quote, strained legal arguments without merit and speculative accusations and unsupported by evidence. After the ruling, Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey became only the fifth Republican senator to congratulate President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, tweeting that President Trump had, quote, exhausted all plausible legal options in the state of Pennsylvania. Late this afternoon, the Trump campaign filed its notice that it will try to overturn the decision in the U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals. In Georgia, the Trump campaign was granted a machine recount of ballots yesterday. President-elect Biden received 12,000 more votes than Mr. Trump, a quarter of a percentage point difference. On Friday, Georgia's Secretary of State certified the presidential results after a week-long audit, a hand recount of the nearly 5 million ballots cast. Georgia's state law allows a candidate to request a recount when there is less than half of one percentage point difference. And a recount continues in two heavily Democratic Wisconsin counties, Dane and Milwaukee, in a state which President Trump lost by 20,000 votes. Yesterday, the Milwaukee County Clerk said the recount was behind schedule due to observers from the Trump campaign being, quote, disruptive by repeatedly asking questions and stopping the counting process. The Wisconsin counties have a December 1st deadline to complete the recount. The head of the Trump administration's coronavirus vaccine program said today that the first immunizations could happen as soon as December 12th. Manjeev Slowey said vaccinations will begin quickly if a Food and Drug Administration Advisory Committee approves an emergency use authorization for Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine at a meeting on December 10th.
Our plan is to be able to ship vaccines to the immunization sites within 24 hours from the approval. So I would expect maybe on day two after approval, on the 11th or on the 12th of December.
Yesterday, the FDA approved the emergency use of the antibody drug Regeneron, which may help patients with mild to moderate COVID-19 symptoms. President Trump was given the experimental drug when he was hospitalized with COVID-19. The United States is experiencing a steady increase in COVID-19 cases and deaths from the disease. The New York Times reports the daily average of confirmed cases is up 59% over the past 2 weeks. Deaths are up 62% and hospitalizations increased 50%. Today, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the country's top infectious disease expert, cautioned Americans to stay home for Thanksgiving, continue to wear masks, and to keep socially distant until vaccines are available for millions of people.
And one of the things when you get COVID fatigue, which is entirely understandable, that people just throw up their hands and say, heck, you know, we're not going to be able to do anything about it. Let's just do what we want to do. That's the wrong decision, because vaccines are coming and they're going to be available relatively soon. If we can hang in there with the mitigation methods and implementing them, yes, we can get out of this.
The United States officially withdrew from the Open Skies Treaty today. The agreement signed in 1992 allows 34 nations to fly over each other's airspace to collect military data and other intelligence. In May, the Trump administration said it would withdraw because Russia was violating the treaty. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who was in Saudi Arabia today, announced the U.S. decision on Twitter, writing, quote, "The United States' withdrawal from the Treaty on Open Skies is now effective. America is more secure because of it, as Russia remains in non-compliance with its obligations." In Guatemala, protesters angry over the country's proposed new budget set fire to the congressional building in Guatemala City yesterday. A small group of protesters kicked in the windows of the building, igniting a fire in the process. Earlier, thousands had gathered to peacefully protest the country's 2021 budget that slashes funding for health and education. Guatemalan President Alejandro Yamatei denounced the arson and announced he was reviewing possible modifications to the budget. Guatemala has seen protests and political upheaval as the country wrestles with widespread allegations of political graft. The protests come after the country was struck by two devastating hurricanes in recent weeks. The storms displaced thousands of people and damaged wide swaths of the country's infrastructure. Mudslides killed more than 50 people around the country. Thousands of people took to the streets of Taipei today. They do not want pork imported from the U.S., which has a drug additive called ractopamine. U.S. pork imports had been banned there because of the drug, but the country recently said imports could begin January 1st of 2021. The drug, which is legal and widely used as a feed additive to produce leaner pork in the United States, is banned in the European Union, China, and Taiwan. Today's demonstration against lifting the ban on U.S. pork imports was part of Taiwan's annual labor march. For updates on the presidential transition and other national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. On Election Day, Puerto Ricans voted in favor of becoming the 51st state. The vote was non-binding and would need the approval of Congress to push statehood forward. I recently spoke with Resident Commissioner of Puerto Rico, Representative Jennifer Gonzalez-Colon, about the possibility of statehood and the hurdles that still lie ahead.
Congress have the responsibility by Constitution to add territories as a state. Even people who were not in favor of statehood before the plebiscite, now they acknowledge that that's the will of the people.
You know, this doesn't happen in a political vacuum. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says, look, this is a Democratic priority. They want to get, Democrats want to get Puerto Rico to be a state so they can get two new senators. But here you are. You often caucus with Republicans. You are, I think, the chair of the Republican Party, right? So how do you assuage those concerns that Republicans in the mainland might have?
Look, there's false preconceptions and false claims about statehood on the island. Republicans, actually, the Republican platform, and you just say it, I'm the GOP chairman in Puerto Rico. I caucus with the Republicans since I was elected in 2016. Now I got reelected for four more years. You got President Ronald Reagan, President Gerald Ford, both President Bush, President Eisenhower, endorsing and supporting statehood for the island, even writing op-eds in Wall Street Journal, in the Republican platform. It is included in this one, 2016, the support of the RNC to Puerto Rico statehood. So I think members in the Republican side that may not agree on this, they cannot use that Puerto Ricans are going to be Democrats, because that's not the reality. Actually, statehood for Puerto Rico has been in the Republican platform since the 1960s. So it's been there. Those personal prejudices that many have, I will be trying to educate and provide facts for the reality of the island.
How would statehood affect almost the twin crises that Puerto Rico has struggled with over the past few years, not just recovering from Hurricane Maria and the other storms since then, but also the financial crisis and the debt that you're in? What would statehood do for those?
first of all, statehood is not going to be a magic wand to resolve all problems, but it will provide opportunities. It will provide equal footing in many of the decisions. Right now, Congress decide the regulations of the air we breathe, the water we drink, and we do not have participation. I mean, I'm the only member representing the island, and we don't have senators. We should be having at least four members of the House. So how the most democratic country in the whole world go to fight for democracy in all corners, and then in your backyard, you still have a territory, you still have a colony. So I truly believe that statehood will provide the same resources Hawaii and Alaska received at that time, and that was the property value will go up dramatically during the first 10 years of statehood in those two former territories. The economy grew more than 100% because of the American flag for investments and properties.
How much do you think the long-term and the large debt that Puerto Rico is in is inhibiting Congress from taking steps?
Well, you know that now it's going to be our fourth year with a fiscal oversight board for the island. And instead of trying to correct and help those fiscal situations on the island, they're just trying to manage all federal funds. Actually, their expenditures are higher and higher. And who paid that? The government of Puerto Rico. We don't really see what's going to happen in the next 3 months. There are some vacancies in the oversight board, so the president still can nominate two more members to the oversight board, and those nominations are not being made yet.
All right, Representative Jennifer Gonzalez-Colon, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Yesterday, St. Mary's College in Maryland held a virtual commemoration unveiling a unique memorial recognizing its role in the history of slavery, entitled From Absence to Presence, the Commemorative to Enslaved Peoples of Southern Maryland. The college is the latest of several institutions to confront and reconcile with a legacy of slavery. The unveiling at St. Mary's capped a years-long journey that began with an archaeological discovery on the campus grounds. NewsHour Weekend's Yvette Feliciano has more.
So what was your initial reaction when you found out that archaeologists had uncovered slave artifacts on the college grounds?
It gave me pause, actually. The college is located in Southern Maryland, which has a history of slavery. But in my mind, I had hoped, or in my heart, I had hoped that we would not have been engaged in that at all.
Tawanda Jordan is the president of St. Mary's College of Maryland. Early in her tenure, college began surveying the campus grounds in preparation for a new stadium complex. In 2016, school archaeologists uncovered evidence of lives once lived on the same grounds that students walk on today. There were 18th and 19th century ceramics, tobacco pipes, and bricks and nails that suggest slave quarters once stood on this very site.
It didn't make me feel very happy, but it was important that we recognize that.
The stadium site was relocated. In its place would be an installation commemorating the lives of enslaved people who toiled on this land long before and even after the founding of the college in 1840.
Where we're located, the community is focused on how the world was from the perspective of the colonists. But an important aspect that was missing from my point of view was the representation from the enslaved people. And they did not have a voice. And this gave an opportunity to present the history of the region from a different perspective.
In October of this year, work began on the installation. There are no statues, no paintings.
So we're really kind of interested in this idea of slave quarters being a very powerful metaphor.
Architects Norman Lee, Shane Albatron, along with poet Quentin Baker, collaborated on the project.
Angela Davis, has a very powerful quote talking about how slave quarters were really the only place where slaves could kind of exist and kind of be human in the sense that they were able to remove themselves from the gaze of slave owners. So at the same time, they were, they were essentially in a prison. The slave quarters themselves were kind of a symbol of empowerment because they could actually live their private lives.
The designers called historical documents 18th and 19th century slave folklore and site-specific archaeological artifacts to present a history that still remains incomplete. The structure is made of wooden slats and reflective stainless steel etched with the poetry of Quentin Baker.
Because of the reflection of the sculpture, it becomes an immersive experience in that the viewer is injected into the storyline through that reflection. Nothing resonates with people more in the visual arts than the human form. And here we are making the viewer that human form, which forces them to pay attention and forces confrontation between the past and the present.
For his part in the project, Baker used language of runaway slave ads from St. Mary's County. Those words became the poetry etched into the steel.
It's an unthinkable reality to live your life as property. And so what I hope the language does is that it brings forth the reality of people as property and the reality of the interiority of individuals who live through this, who still loved and cared and laughed and hurt and bled and broke and existed in a reality of non-existence. That's an impossible thing to think about and an impossible thing to consider, but that was also what happened.
St. Mary's College is not the only institution coming to terms with its legacy of slavery. In addition to a number of other steps, Georgetown University now offers preferential admission to descendants of enslaved people held by the university. The University of Virginia created a consortium of schools to research and address their historical ties perpetuating slavery.
This is a moment right now where a lot of higher ed institutions are trying to grapple with their legacies of slavery. Do you feel there's an appropriate way to memorialize this history?
I don't think there's one way by which to memorialize the history. Everyone has to do what feels right to them. I think there's an improper way to do it, and that is to not to tell the full story.
Some might say the journey to this commemorative has been a passion project for St. Mary's College of Maryland. Students were engaged in the archaeological dig. There are courses and special projects exploring this period of slavery. And the community helped decide who would design the art installation. Jordan sees pursuing this history as a duty of a higher education institution.
When you tell the history of a place, and of course, as life evolves, perspectives change, but they don't change as much when you are inclusive in the telling of that history and you lend voice to those who have been silenced in the past. And that this commemorative lends voice to the enslaved people. And that should set us on the path to do better in this country.
To hear the poetry read by Quentin Baker at yesterday's unveiling, visit pbs.org/newshour. The water crisis in Flint, Michigan illuminated broader issues nationwide, from contaminated drinking water to water shortages. Erin Brockovich, an environmental activist who became well known for her successful lawsuit against the Pacific Gas and Electric Company in 1993, is tackling the crisis in her recent book, Superman's Not Coming, Our National Water Crisis and What We the People Can Do About It. NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker reports.
So I wanted to start with the title. Why is Superman not coming?
Because I go to communities all the time that are dealing with water contamination and people who are sick. And they always seem comforted by the fact, well, okay, the EPA has shown up, so it's going to be okay. Or, well, the Department of Health, why weren't they here? But they should have our back. It's going to be okay. And I was always the one that was the bearer of bad news. I mean, no one's coming to fix this.
And after years spent looking into America's water supply, Brockovich has assembled an arsenal of bad news.
We all know about Flint, Michigan. There's 200 more Flint, Michigans out there. There's one, if not multiple, communities in every state across the United States of America. And you may never think Flint will be you, but it's already you. And they're everywhere.
In 2018, using data from the Environmental Protection Agency, the Natural Resources Defense Council found that nearly 30 million Americans drank water from community systems that violated the EPA's lead and copper rule. Whether it's crumbling infrastructure, antiquated regulations, or chemicals being allowed to enter the water supply, Brockovich's book lays out a system well beyond the breaking point.
When you look at the United States, are we seeing these problems more acutely in underserved communities? Is this a question of disparity and inequality? Are communities that are perhaps economically distressed more likely to be facing these water issues?
You do see that. I have absolutely seen communities with socioeconomic factors and they've been polluted. I also see it in affluent communities, and I've seen it in, you know, middle America, Hannibal, Missouri, where it's not rich, it's not the socioeconomic situation where they can't get involved, but middle America. So it affects all of us, and I think that's an important message.
While Brockovich's book paints a dire portrait of America's water crisis, she's optimistic.
While you argue that this is happening everywhere in the country, outside of Flint, is there anywhere in the country where a community is meeting this head-on or is further down the line in addressing their water situation?
They are, and we share those stories with you in the book, the Ladies of Hannibal, Missouri. They're such amazing examples. So they had lead in their water, some places higher than Flint, because they used ammonia in the system. So it started with a couple of moms, and I have to tell you, 99% of the time, every community we're in, it's one pissed off mom. I don't know if I can say that on PBS, but it's true. And they're like, oh no, I'm not having this for my child or my neighbor's child or my sister's child. So they begin to activate. They oftentimes will call us and we go out and we begin to educate them on what's going on with their system. In Hannibal, they took off, they went door to door and educated the town about ammonia and why it was causing lead. And so the community became involved. And as of March 2020, Hannibal, Missouri now has lead-free water. I think that's amazing. Imagine if every community across the board and every municipality across the board did that, we'd solve a problem.
What would you recommend to a viewer that sees this and says, you know, I think there may be something up with my water supply?
The first step, know your water source. I've had so many conversations, people are like, I don't know my water company. I'm like, well, that's one of the first things you might want to find out. And look at your water bill. And if you don't have or get every quarter some water quality report, which they have to give you, either get online now, know who your water provider is, get online or make a phone call and say, send me my water quality report and read it. That's the first step. Take a step. Just take an action. And don't come in with thinking I'm going to save the world. And don't come in with the fear, what if I'm wrong? Who cares if you were wrong? At least you asked. At least you found out. Knowledge is power.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend, Sunday.
With Thanksgiving just days away, we turn to our partners from PBS Student Reporting Labs and Andrea Salazar-Lopez to hear how they are safely distancing this holiday season.
Thank you. I was eating soup.
It sounds so good.
This year, my friends and I did our annual Friendsgiving meal over Zoom.
So my grandpa lives in a nursing home, so we can't have Thanksgiving with him this year. I haven't been able to see people who are really important to me in months.
It's really hard having such a large family during this time. I just want all of us to be under one roof, but we can't because I'm scared for their health. So how can we gather more safely for this Thanksgiving?
For family and friends who are elderly or vulnerable, the best option might be to include them on Zoom.
You know, we're not going to have a Thanksgiving with, you know, 12 of us gathered around the, you know, around the table this year.
If you can, eat outside.
But I'm really grateful for my big covered porch. I will turn the outdoors into a dining environment. Even outdoors, space is still important. And wearing masks is still important. Indoors, we'd recommend everything we can think of in terms of minimizing that risk of transmission.
Greet your family members with hand sanitizer.
Maybe we can try to center the gatherings not around a meal.
If you do decide to eat together, consider eating in shifts. Spread out in different parts of your house and crack windows open frequently to increase ventilation.
You know, grandma or auntie, we can't do this dinner tonight. We love you too much.
This year, we're still going to try to see each other. We're going to be socially distanced and eating outside.
I'm thankful that, we're all here and we get to hang out over Zoom and stuff. It's nice to see you guys.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. And wherever you are and however you celebrate this year, happy Thanksgiving. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfine Foundation, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.